Hello, I'm Mike Baker. I'd like to give you a flavour of our discussion on the economics of learning. The setting was inspirational and apt. We were inside Tower Bridge, astride the Thames at the heart of London, with road and river traffic teeming far below. It was inspirational because it offered a new perspective on some of the most familiar sights of London, and new perspectives on familiar problems were exactly what were being sought. In this case, the quest was for new approaches to the traditional delivery models of learning. And it was apt because Tower Bridge was, at the time of its construction, a perfect example of an innovative lateral thinking solution to a long-term problem, namely how to get London's increasingly busy traffic over a river port whose shipping could not be disrupted. The mission impossible for the participants of this unusual thinking was how to overcome the funding and infrastructure problems facing a developing world nation as it tried to join the most important, competitive and rapidly evolving activity in the world, the creation of a knowledge economy. The participants had travelled from all over the world and comprised educators and economists, teachers and administrators, bankers and entrepreneurs. At the heart of the questions they were asked were several core dilemmas facing policymakers around the world. First, who should pay for education? Governments, employers, or individuals? Second, what sort of education will the citizen of an uncertain future need? Basic literacy and numeracy? Traditional factual content? Practical skills? Problem-solving capabilities? An aptitude for team working? Or IT skills? Although the challenge was set in a fictional developing world country, the issues it raised were equally relevant to advanced economies. The organiser and chair of the two-day event, Professor Stephen Heppel, opened with an excursion around some notable and radical departures from the norm of schooling. These included the City Academy in the English Midlands that has adopted, in its entirety, the school curriculum from Queensland, Australia. What did this tell us about the need for a national curriculum? Should schools be free to pick and mix their curriculum from anywhere in the world? If this seems a strange concept in education, why is it considered normal in other spheres? If there are only a handful of countries that excel in manufacturing cars, with the rest content to import what they cannot make so well or so efficiently, why do we think every country needs its own curriculum? Is a national curriculum like the national airlines of the past, more a national virility symbol than a necessity? Why not have an international, open-source, online curriculum? And what about school size? Stephen cited the 1,000-pupil school in the Caribbean, which, after it was divided into four separate schools, not only delivered average results that were two grades better than before, but also created a more civilised, less brutal environment. And why should classrooms be in buildings dedicated purely for pupils and teaching? What about a school in a retail shopping mall, as tried in Thailand, where children and adults can pop in for a period of learning, or simply to read a book, in between the food shopping and buying their newspaper or magazine? Indeed, do we really need a school building at all? Stephen described the success of Not School, a virtual school for pupils who had been excluded from their bricks and mortar schools. As the power of social networking sites like YouTube or Facebook have shown, young people avidly learn from one another via the web. Stephen introduced the group to the Learnometer project, which suggests that learning trends are moving away from teacher-oriented, subject-based, formal environments towards learner-friendly, topic-based, informal or virtual environments. The world is also moving from a one-to-many model towards a peer-to-peer model. A generation weaned on YouTube, Wikipedia and Google may find it odd that one person in authority should hold all the answers. So what ideas and questions emerged from the group? Stephen Healy and Katerina Taylor took the view that the private sector is the true source of innovation. They argued that while governments tend to be driven by short-term goals, the private sector could take risks and take longer-term horizons. So the key task for policymakers should be first to focus on educational outputs, not inputs. Secondly, they should deregulate the system to foster private sector involvement, while still using the public sector to monitor quality. Janice Dolan and Doug Brown stress that technology is only a resource. It is not a substitute for learning. They advise policymakers that the key issue is not resources, but about how to provide professional support for teachers. They also advise that getting second-hand technology to developing world countries does not work. Indeed, it may cost more in the long run. It was much better to get big companies to invest in a country with the incentive of a realistic long-term payback. James Penny and Lindsay Bird stressed the value in using existing infrastructures. If there are no computer networks or broadband structures, there are other technologies that can be employed, radio stations or mobile phone networks. They advise that the first step in reform should involve overcoming the cultural, political and behavioural challenges, and it would be essential to make this context the starting point. It would not work to seek to impose wholesale a model that may have worked well in other places. As economists, Sandra McNally and Harry Patronos insisted on the importance of evidence-based policies. They argued that the government of the developing country must be shown the evidence of the social and economic benefits of education. Since there would always be great competition for resources from other public policy areas, it was vital to undertake systematic evaluation of education projects to demonstrate the return on the investment. So, how to summarise this fizzing and freewheeling discussion? There is fuller detail elsewhere on this website, but let me try to identify a few common strands. Technology, or the lack of it, should not be allowed to become a barrier. Computers and virtual learning environments are only a tool. They are not a substitute for learning. There must be clarity about the aims of learning. Governments must decide what they want the outputs to be. In a fast-changing world, these might include the aim of creating lifelong learners, developing ITC skills, and producing problem solvers and confident decision makers. Communities must be involved in their own learning, and their voice should help to drive the direction of reform. Local cultural and behavioural conditions should be adapted to unless there are strong ethical reasons for not doing so. Learning need not be confined within the physical boundaries of the traditional schoolroom. It should reach out to the community and should encourage peer-to-peer learning. Governments should resist the temptation to set short-term targets. They should consider involving the private sector, which will usually be better at innovation and at taking a long-term view. Short-term accountability measures such as externally set tests should be used with caution. Existing testing regimes such as university or high school entrance tests could be a barrier to curriculum reform. Goals should not be set by input measures, but by outputs. Governments should decide first what they want to achieve, not how many schools or teachers they want. And finally, all policy should be evaluated and driven by evidence. So, perhaps then, the spirit of the two-day conversation could be characterised by the words of the poet William Butler Yeats. Education is not the filling of a bucket, but the lighting of a fire.